If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week we're going to be celebrating 100 years since the publication of F. Scott Fitzgerald's masterpiece, The Great Gatsby. And I'm joined by one of the language's leading authorities on the subject, Professor Sarah Churchwell, who, as well as having written a book about 10 years ago called Careless People, Murder, Mayhem, and the Invention of The Great Gatsby, has also contributed an introduction to a magnificent new centennial edition published by Cambridge of The Great Gatsby. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
You say, as maybe a kind of central argument of the introduction you contribute to this book, that nowadays we kind of get Gatsby wrong, that our idea about the book is not borne out by what the book actually is. Can you explain why that is?
Absolutely. Well, there's sort of two ways to answer that question. One is kind of why that is in terms of how it came about, and also why that is in terms of how it plays out, if you see what I mean. And the question of how it came about is actually the easier one, which is mostly Hollywood. So we have all these cliches about the 1920s and about the jazz age and about the roaring 20s, and a lot of those come to us via Hollywood. And then what's happened is that we've kind of superimposed those cliches back onto the novel, and we've made a bunch of assumptions. And this is partly about adaptations of Gatsby specifically, but also more broadly, just, you know, kind of films and stories of the 20s. And then we make a bunch of assumptions about this novel that we think is the quintessential novel of the 20s. And so we're just like, well, it must have all of these things. But it doesn't. When you actually go look at it, a lot of the things that we associate with the 20s don't happen in that novel. And the most obvious one, the one I come back to and I talk about in the introduction, for example, is the Charleston. There's no Charleston. The word doesn't appear in the novel. So everyone thinks they're dancing the Charleston at Gatsby's parties, and they think that because of Hollywood, but they're not. And that's because the novel is set in a very specific point in time. It's set in 1922. It's written in 1924, published in 1925. The Charleston, as it happens, becomes a dance craze in the late 1925, basically in 1926. In other words, after the novel is published. So Fitzgerald probably hadn't seen it danced. And if he had, he didn't really realize what it was going to become, that it was going to become this phenomenon when Gatsby was published. So the analogy that I always use, and the kind of timing is perfect because we're exactly a century later now, right, is a novel published now in early 2025 that was written in 2024 and set in 2022. We would all know exactly all of the details. We would recognize all of the allusions and everything. But then imagine if something, you know, that is incredibly important culturally that happens in the next 6 months, and then everybody says, oh, that happened in 2022. Well, anybody who remembered it would be like, that didn't happen until 2026, you know?
Yep.
And that's basically where we are. Now, some of those details don't matter, but some of them kind of do. And that's sort of what I'm trying to get at in the intro.
Well, I'll come back to that question because I think it's a really interesting one about the historical specificity of the novel itself. But there is a wider question about, if you like, the vibe. I mean, this is a novel that, you know, I just reread it because I'm a good boy and I do my homework for this podcast, and was reminded again of how blackly, bleakly desolating a book it is, and how little it is about glamour and romance. And, you know, it's wildly funny, but you know, this is not a cheerful tale of careless jazz age jollies.
Exactly.
And yet there is, you know, we all sort of think, you know, every meme in the world has Leonardo DiCaprio raising a champagne glass. Of the world. Exactly. Is it just people haven't bothered to read it? Or is it that the power of Gatsby's self-projection has kind of overwhelmed people in the same way that you kind of get that with Paradise Lost, that everyone goes, you know, Satan's so powerful in book one, he's surely the hero of this.
Yeah. I think there's a little bit of that. I think that it is, as I say, some of that is about Hollywood. So, you know, maybe probably more people have seen the films than have read the books, just because that's the way our culture is. More people see the visual media than read the books. But a lot of people have read the book. And the thing is you know, it sticks with you with these memories of glamour. And it's easy to forget the darkness that you're rightly pulling out there, Sam. And I think that's incredibly important. And as you know, it's something I really focus on in my book about Gatsby for exactly that reason, because I think that we keep not paying attention to the darkness of the story, which is crucial, I think, to Fitzgerald's meanings. But we remember the glamour of it because of the power of Fitzgerald's writing, because his writing is so incredibly vivid and memorable, and because it's so rich in sensory perception, and because it's so surprising. It sticks in our head, even if we aren't conscious of it. Even, I think, often more if we aren't conscious of it, that it just paints this incredibly vivid picture. And we all want to join those parties. We want to, he knows how to create this impression of glamour better than anybody else, the sense of magic and enchantment in modern life. And that's kind of, as you know, a lot of what I try to do in this introduction is to kind of get to grips with how he does that with his language and the ways in which he actually technically accomplishes that. Because one of the other things I'm trying to do in the introduction is to really take on this another kind of cliche or received wisdom that we have, which is that Fitzgerald wasn't really very bright. He just kind of accidentally tripped and wrote The Great Gatsby, like one of the great novels of the 20th century, you know, but that he wasn't really that smart. And he just kind of, I don't even know how people think he did it if they think he wasn't smart. But so I kind of want to get to the fact that there's a lot of very, very skillful writing in this book, which is why it is so effective and so powerful and why it sticks in your head. And he puts that energy into evoking that glamour. So we come away with this impression of glamour, and that kind of can override the other stuff that Fitzgerald is doing in the novel, but I think to the detriment of our understanding of what it is that he's up to.
Is that a failure that could be laid at his door, in the sense that if he's writing something that is so lush and that is so bewitching, that his audience kind of misses what he's actually getting at?
Yeah. I mean, look, you could kind of say that, but it's like, at what point are we going to say that that's an artistic failure? And at what point are we just going to say, like, it's like, you know, okay, so Mozart's Dies Irae, it's apocalyptic and it's terrible. And yet what we remember is the grandeur and the glory of the music. Are we going to say that that's an artistic failing on Mozart's part? I'm not sure. So, I mean, I take your point, but I think it is, as I say in the introduction, he's walking a tightrope in this novel in ways that I think that people who haven't really kind of, you know, put it under a microscope the way that I have and other scholars have, you know, again, shouldn't appreciate. He doesn't necessarily want you to put the novel under a microscope, but that it's an experimental novel in ways that people don't always appreciate. And he's experimenting with exactly that question of how far can you push the glamour? And so, yes, you might argue he overdoes it and that he doesn't get the darkness in there enough, but it's there. It's absolutely there. And so it's partly about what we're paying attention to and what we're not paying attention to. He gives us both. And we tend to focus on one and not the other.
I mean, do you have a strong sense of what he thought he was about? I mean, he was very purposive in writing this book and these wonderful letters to Maxwell Perkins, where he's sort of saying, I'm going to try and write something that's beyond what I'm capable of writing. It was he was really shooting for the boundaries with this book. But do you have a sense of what he was trying to do with it? What he saw the book as being?
Yeah, I do. Although it can be a little bit hard to articulate because, as you say, he was sort of shooting for the moon. I mean, the fundamental thing that he wanted to do is he wanted to prove he was a great writer. And that may sound like I'm not really answering your question, but that was he was sure that he had it in him to be a great artist. And he'd written these popular things and people kept detracting and saying, you know, and kind of diminishing his accomplishment, being like, well, you're just a popular writer. And he was sick of it. So he sat down to show that he could do something really artistic. That's number one. Number two, he was inspired to write the book in the summer of 1922, which, as I know your devoted listeners of the Spectator podcast will know, is the great year of literary modernism, right? It's the year that opens with the publication of Ulysses in February 1922, and it closes with the publication of The Wasteland, T.S. Eliot's great modernist poem, at the end of the year. So Fitzgerald wants to show that he can do something like that, but in his métier. He wants it to be his story, but to show that he can do something as artistic as that. He was also reading an enormous amount of Joseph Conrad, and Conrad was similarly seen as very modernist at the time in a way that maybe people you know, have kind of lost sight of now. So what he wanted to do, and he says this in one of the famous letters to Perkins, was something new. So that's why it's a little bit hard to answer the question of what it was he wanted to do. He just wanted to do something new and fabulous. And he was going to figure out what that new and fabulous thing was when he sat down to write it. But to answer your question more specifically, as he worked it out, I think that what he wanted to do was to show that he could show himself, that he could do something that had great intellectual merit, actually, which is part of what I argue in the introduction, that this is a much more interesting novel of ideas than most people think that it is, that he wanted to do something that was incredibly beautiful and modern, and that his favorite writer of all time always was Keats. And he wanted to compete with Keats. He wanted to show that he could learn from Keats and that he could do Keats. And basically, he puts Keats to jazz, is what he does in this novel. That's what he does.
That's very nicely put. But at the same time, the way we read it now, it's something that's quite un-Keatsian, isn't it? I mean, we have come to see it, I think rightly, as a novel that's absolutely about America and its broken promises and its idealisms, not just in the kind of vulgar sense, but in the kind of always Kantian sense. And it's, you know, the way in which materialism kind of undermines it.
Yeah.
And about lack of community and carelessness, all the things, that the American themes that are in this book. But that's not the Keats side of it at all, is it?
No, but, well, you mentioned Kant in passing there, and I think that it's about romantic ideas of life, right? And Keats is the great poet of the kind of romantic possibilities of life and the transience of it, but the great romantic glamour of possibility itself, of your hope in what you think life might be able to bring, even in one perfect moment or one moment of trapped potential or lost potential. And, you know, the great poet of exaltation. And that kind of combines with a more philosophical idea. And you mentioned the more familiar. So basically, there are the more familiar versions of it in the novel are, as you say, about American materialism, about how America's materialism undermines its own idealism. So we have this utopian ideal of the society that we're going to build. And basically the way the novel ends is, you know, mankind comes to the edge of the spectacular continent. Of course, he sees it as man for the first time. Obviously, it's Europeans for the first time. But they come to the spectacular continent. They see all of the world's possibility in front of them. And what do? They build Las Vegas. Like, that's basically what he's saying, right? You know, you cut down paradise, you put up a parking lot, right? That's basically it. So it's that kind of materialism undermining the great potential, you know, spiritual ideals of a more utopian society. But it's also, to your point, a more philosophical idea about how materialism in life generally tends to undercut our idealism as a species, right? So that we have all of this potential to imagine something great. And then the material reality of our lives is always undercutting that. And that's partly what the novel is about. It's about aspiration, but it's about how aspiration is about these ideals that we form in our head and how material reality can never live up to that. So that if in that kind of reading, Gatsby's tragedy isn't that American society lets him down. It's that the world can never offer anything as great as his imagination can conceive of that, what, you know, we would call in a philosophical mode, that Platonic ideal, that the material reality is always inferior.
Well, that's sort of what makes him, albeit in a very qualified way, a hero, isn't it?
I think it's what's redemptive. As you say, it's very qualified, right? So it's potentially redemptive. And then one of the great kind of moral questions that the novel poses is that kind of idealism and imagination and fidelity. It's also a novel very much about fidelity to an ideal. Is that redemptive of corruption? Because it's very important that Gatsby is corrupt. So is it enough to be an idealist if your idealism is also corrupted? And kind of this question about corruption and redemption is sort of what Fitzgerald is playing out.
No.
What I also sort of wonder very slightly, you know, Fitzgerald is one of literature's most famous alcoholics.
Mm.
And it's sometimes been said that alcoholism is a sort of balked quest for transcendence. Is there something in here, in the booziness of it, in the idea that they're, you know, and you, I think it's you who quote, I don't think it's in the book, you know, take the cue from Browning, you know, the Andrea del Sarto line that man's reach and exceed his grasp, else what's heaven for? That there's something kind of baked into the book that has to do with that, those moments of irrecoverable transcendence that they find when they're all drunk and happy and then suddenly the car's going in the ditch.
Yeah, absolutely. So you said at the top, the way Fitzgerald puts that Browning idea is in the letter to Perkins that he writes, which I quote at the opening of the intro, kind of shapes my intro, is this paradoxical idea that he has, that he wants to do something better than he's capable of, right? Which is a paradox. By definition, you can only do what you're capable of, right? And I love that idea of trying to exceed your own capacity. And what he thinks is that art itself might help us exceed our own capacity. And so, yes, so art can get us to that kind of exalted, elevated pitch of existence, but so can drunkenness. And he's, at least it can, when the glamour's happening and the fun parts, before it all wears off and you end up in a ditch, as you say. And so he says stuff much to that effect in his previous novel, The Beautiful and Damned, where he says that when you're, he writes this kind of wonderfully evocative passage about the glamour of exactly that moment of tipsiness when the world takes on a beautiful cast and everything just seems kind of a little bit fuzzy, but a little bit glamorous and a little bit fabulous and everything's at a heightened point. And he was very acutely aware of that capacity that, you know, the alcohol could have, as you say, for limited moments. But, you know, and it was certainly neither one of us wants to suggest that alcoholism was part of his art or anything like that. But I do think that in his mind, as it is for a lot of artists who are addicts, it's a shortcut to that exaltation. It's a way to kind of try to get there faster and then see if you can recapture that high.
Yeah. One thing we haven't talked about yet, but it seems to me really important to so much of the book's effects and its shape and the kind of tensions in it, is the narrator, Nick Carraway. How do you read his mediation of the story, both in terms of kind of class and in terms of his sort of moral outlook on life? Because he's not a kind of random stenographer, is he? He's taking views all the way through.
Absolutely. His judgment is absolutely crucial to the way that the novel works. And he is a character who exercises judgment all of the time. He begins the novel by saying that he reserves judgment, which he doesn't. And by the end of the never. And by the end of the novel, he's making all kinds of judgments. And he uses the word judgment constantly. It's one of his kind of, you know, leitmotifs. So he's a very judgy character, actually, Nick Carraway, which I think makes him a much better character. To me, he's the one who, the most of them are misread by Hollywood, most of the characters in the novel. They're always very, very mischaracterized in a way that's almost surprising. But Nick Carraway is the most. So anybody who's seen any of the Hollywood versions knows that in all of them, he's this naive. He's this callow 20-year-old who's following them all around wide-eyed, going, "Ooh, Gatsby, you're so cool. I want to be your best friend. And ooh, Tom Buchanan, you're so rich. I want to be your best friend." In the novel, he's completely caustic about both of them. He is the same age as them. He thinks they're both kind of awful in their different ways, especially at first. And then one of the things that happens is that he comes to see that underneath Gatsby's vulgar and ridiculous exterior, which is really important how the novel works. Again, people who only know it from, you know, the Leo DiCaprio movie or whatever, probably don't realize how clearly Nick indicates that they all find Gatsby kind of ridiculous.
But the old sport thing.
The old sport, this affectation, they can all see through it. They're like, "What are you talking about?" The drunk character, Owl Eyes, who sits in the library, he says, "It's amazing that the library is real." He's been drunk for a week, and he says, "I came to the library to see if I could sober up." And then he says, "But the thing about this library, Gatsby's library, right, in his spectacular mansion, is," he says, "the thing that's amazing about it is it's absolutely real," right? In other words, they can all tell he's a fake. Even a guy who's been drunk for a week is amazed that he has a real library.
Yeah, although we could qualify that, because I think he does go on to say, doesn't he, that it's a real library, but he didn't go as far as to cut any of the pages of the books.
Exactly. He says it's the perfect detail because it's so realistic, because a guy like him would buy the books but not cut the pages and actually read the books, right? Exactly. So he says, perfect. Perfect. So there, and that's, you said earlier, it's a funny book. It is a funny book once you get attuned to its comedy, but it is a comedy kind of its moment. And you start, it's tonal. You have to kind of hear it. You have to hear a very facetious tone. It's very tongue in cheek and wry, a lot of the humor. And
oh, it's deadpan, but it's there all the way through, isn't it?
All the way through. Like, exactly.
I mean, I did a double take when there was sort of, you know, a couple of young ladies. That's better. Involved in an obstetric conversation.
Undergraduates trying to get young women in an obstetric conversation. And that's very much Fitzgerald's sense of humor. So basically with Gatsby and Nick Carraway, what you get is that Nick's sense of humor is deadpan. And he's very mordant about the world that he's observing. He's a cynic. And so to play him as a naif who then, you know, his illusions are lost. No. He comes in. This is really important, actually. He opens the story. He's a veteran. He was on the Western Front. He's come back to the Midwest, and he says he was so bored returning to the Midwest, that he wants some excitement again. And he moves to New York partly because he's looking for excitement, because he enjoyed, he says, he uses the word enjoyed, that he enjoyed his adventures on the front. So he's a typical example of a popular song at the time that you'll know, Sam, and I'm sure many of your spectators, listeners will also know well from the First World War, which is How You Gonna Keep Them Down on the Farm After They've Seen Paris. That's him. He's not traumatized by the war. He had a good time, and he misses the excitement. Now, we can argue about whether that's a realistic depiction of a veteran, but that is what Nick Carraway says about his own experience at the beginning of the novel and why he's going to New York. So we need to understand him as that kind of person. And then those are the judgments that he starts to make. And what he sees in Gatsby then is not a loss of his own illusions, but actually, I think part of Fitzgerald's idea is that he wants to flip the cliches on their heads. And so what he sees in Gatsby is the possibility of recovering a lost idealism. He starts out cynical and he starts to regain, you can never really regain the illusions of your youth, can you? But he regains the belief in the importance of having ideals, is how I read Nick over the course of the novel.
Yeah. And his class situation is also important, isn't it? Because he's sort of in the middle.
Yeah, he's very middle class, right? He sits right between Gatsby and Tom. And again, I think this is something that today we find it harder to read the class positions of the day and also the way that Fitzgerald writes about them in kind of euphemistic and implicit language. There's a lot of reading between the lines that's required in Gatsby. And I think sometimes people are today are a little out of practice in picking up some of the cues. But exactly. So Nick is middle class, but he's very well educated. So he went to Yale. It's probably worth saying that Fitzgerald, as a loyal Princeton man, was always suspicious. He was very dubious about people who went to Yale. He absolutely was. He's always cracking
jokes. Black mark against Nick.
Yeah, it is. It's a black mark against Nick. This is really important. With Fitzgerald's tongue in his cheek. But he is, it's exactly like, you know, an Oxford man making cracks about, you know, well, he only went to Cambridge. So Nick being a Yalie is not a good sign. So he's from a middle-class mercantile family. He says that. His family runs a successful hardware business in the Midwest. But they've made enough money that they can send him to a good university. And he is, you know, extremely intelligent. So he's upwardly social. So, you know, and Gatsby wants to shortcut all of that upward social mobility through, well, and he doesn't have the opportunities early in his life, but he does it through criminality. And then Tom Buchanan is inherited wealth. He's the leisure class. He's what they would call the rentier class at that time, right? He doesn't work. He's got tons of money. He runs around playing polo and traveling the world and having mistresses and cheating on his wife and all of this stuff. And that's what he does. And he's the aristocrat. An American aristocrat for British listeners, but very much an aristocrat. He's comparatively old money. Gatsby is 100% new money. And Nick Carraway sits in the middle as the middle class representative of an ordinary American watching this tension between old and new money play out.
Yeah.
Can I ask a bit, because we've so far been too delicate really to address what, at least on the face of it, is the center of this book, which is the love story.
Yeah.
Gatsby's unrelenting love for Daisy. And I'm sure most of our listeners will know or remember, but Gatsby creates this persona, creates this life, throws all these parties, essentially because for 5 years solid, he's simply completely obsessed with his childhood or young manhood sweetheart, Daisy, who is now married to Tom. And Gatsby believes, sort of wrongly, Nick suggests, that Daisy has loved him all this time secretly, even though she hoofed off and married Tom. How seriously do you read Daisy's carelessness in the book? Because there are some hints that she's weak rather than entirely cynical, that she did have something for Gatsby. Or am I misreading that?
No, I mean, look, first of all, I'm not going to be dogmatic about reading or misreading a book that is as full of implications as this one. So there's lots of openness to how we read certain scenes where Fitzgerald, you know, doesn't close down the meanings of them. But for myself, certainly there's an indication that she cared about him, but I would say in her careless way. There are limits to her care, her ability to care. By the time we encounter her in the story in real time, because there are flashback sections in the novel, by the time we encounter her in real time, she's pretty cynical. But yes, when she marries Tom, she gets a letter from Gatsby. She sent him what was called a Dear John letter at the time, right? She rejects him. She throws him over, saying she's going to marry Buchanan. He's still in Europe after the war. He's in England. And she writes him a letter, says, I'm going to marry Tom. And he writes her a letter back, and we never find out what's in the contents of the letter. But it upsets her enough that she gets drunk and hysterical and insists that she's not going to marry Tom. But then they pull her together. They, like, you know, do the equivalent of pouring coffee down her throat, and they throw her in a cold shower, and they zip up her dress. And then we are told the next day she married Tom without so much as a shiver. And then when Tom and Gatsby have a kind of battle over her at the climax of the novel, Gatsby wants her to repudiate the idea that she ever loved Tom at all. He says, I want you to say you never loved him. And Tom says, what, you never loved me on our honeymoon when we were in Hawaii that time I carried your shoes for you and I carried you down to the beach. And she starts crying and says, I can't say it, right? So the thing that I say that always really annoys people who love this novel, and particularly who love the Hollywood, I say lots of things that annoy people who love it, including the Charleston part, which always disappoints people. But another one is to point out that Gatsby's a stalker. He just is. Yeah. Like, she says to him, we're breaking up, I'm getting married, and he will not accept that. So he gets this fortune to try to win her back, and then he buys a house as close to her as he can get. He cuts out, he has little cuttings of her from the newspapers. He keeps a scrapbook of all of the places that he sees her in the paper. So I always say, like, in a different movie, this is the moment where the serial killer reveals his, like, man cave with all of the photographs of the woman that he's been stalking, and then he's gonna, you know, murder, right? It's really creepy. He's surveilling her and he won't let her go.
Do you think Fitzgerald saw it that way, or is that a reading we're bringing to it?
I think he understands that what Gatsby is doing is self-deluding. I think that he would raise an eyebrow at hearing me say that, but he was also fundamentally honest and he had a really good sense of humor. And I think he would recognize the justice of it. You know, once we explain the terms to him and stuff, he would be like, yeah, that's actually fair. But he also thinks that Gatsby's fidelity is admirable. And that's really crucial. And so do I, to be clear. He's a stalker, but you also have to kind of admire the fact that he won't give up. And so it's that tension that the novel is inviting us to inhabit, is that moral tension, is shouldn't he just give up? Should he just give up? Should he just let her go? She is fundamentally incapable of meeting him halfway. And so I think that when people talk about it as like a star-crossed love affair or something like that, that's when I'm always like, hang on, guys, because that's very much Gatsby's perspective on their affair. He thinks they're star-crossed lovers, but she's pissed off and married somebody else. And she's having, you know, but she's mad at her husband. She's basically having a revenge affair with Gatsby over the summer. And she thinks about running away with him until she comes to his party in chapter 6 and she sees the world that he inhabits. And then she wants no more part of it. And basically the affair starts to break down at that point when she realizes she doesn't want to be part of his world.
Yeah. I mean, something that I had forgotten was there's actually a kid involved in there.
Yeah. It? Yeah. Well, that's because Gatsby forgets about the kid.
I mean, that's very, very on the down low, even in the book.
Yeah. Well, the kid's more present than you think she is, but Gatsby forgets about the kid, right? And Nick has some very caustic comments about that, about how Gatsby seemed to be surprised that there was actually a human child, even though in theory he knows that she is a kid, but he's like, oh my God, it's an actual child. And Gatsby hasn't thought through the practicalities. So he thinks that Daisy's going to run off with him, but like, okay, what's going to happen to the kid, you know? So when he sees the kid, it's like, and the scene is a really powerful one, actually, because Fitzgerald shows how it throws Gatsby, because he has this fantasy. And that's why I said a minute ago that I think that Fitzgerald would recognize the legitimacy of describing him as a stalker, because he certainly is showing Gatsby as a fantasist. He knows that Gatsby is a fantasist very clearly. That's part of how the story works. And Daisy's a pragmatist, right? There's a complicated layer of narration, but basically it's Daisy's friend Jordan who tells us what happened when she married Tom. And what Daisy says via Nick is that when Daisy's waiting for Gatsby to come back from the war, she waits for a little while. She doesn't throw him over instantly. She waits for a bit. But then we're told that she wanted the choice to be made for her by some practical force. She needed something to make up her mind for her. And it's not going to be love, and it's not going to be fidelity to an ideal. It's just, and it was like, it could be money, it could be sex, it could be something, but it's something practical is going to be what makes up Daisy's mind, because fundamentally she's a pragmatist. And that's why, in one sense, you can map the story as a battle between idealism and pragmatism and cynicism. And cynicism wins.
Yeah.
Hard. It wins hard. It wins like brutally, right? It wins hands down.
It really does. And I mean, you know, part of the American promise of Manifest Destiny, you know, is religious in component. Where does religion come into this book? Because in as much as it does, it seems to me, it's these gigantic
disembodied eyes of T.J. Eckelberg glaring over the Valley of Ashes, which itself is a very biblical kind of mise-en-scene, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it does come in a couple of other places. There's also, in fact, Fitzgerald quotes the Bible at one point, or paraphrases it, in a famous passage that was famous both from the Bible and from Gatsby, where he says that Gatsby is American, and he says he's the son of God, and therefore must be about his father's business. And Fitzgerald there is kind of punning on the idea that the religion of America is the marketplace and that commerce is America's great religion. And so to your point about Eckelberg, to the famous billboard, the eyes of the oculist T.J. Eckelberg, so that an advertisement is what passes for God in the soulless American 1920s. It's God, it's a businessman, it's a corrupt business, so that all of the possibilities of a more, I wouldn't use a word like religion because it's not that organized in the novel, but a word more like spiritual. All the possibilities of a more spiritual, meaningful life have been lost in this cynical material scrabble for power and status and money.
Well, there's that green light, isn't there?
That's what people often forget, I find, in Europe, that I first learned this when I came over here, lo these many years ago, and was teaching Gatsby for the first time to British students. And we go through the symbolism of that green light. And it's very, very famous symbol in literature, right? So what does it stand for? Well, green stands for envy, and it stands for spring, and it stands for hope, it stands for renewal. And with British students, I'd be like, and it was a real thought. I'm like, and in America, it's the color of money, right? Green is the color of money. And of course, it wouldn't resonate for British students. Why would it? It's not the color of money here. But in America, green is the color of money, right? So it's all of those things together.
Yeah. Something that's always intrigued me, it's a sort of side question. What do you make of the fact that he produced an epigraph to the book from an entirely fictitious poet, which was him?
Yeah, which was him from his previous novel. It's a really good question. I'm glad you asked it, if only because I've been sitting here like being very omniscient about this because I've spent so much time grappling with Gatsby. There are a couple of moments in the book that I have never answered to my own satisfaction, and that's one of them. I can offer but I don't find them particularly persuasive. My best answer, and it's not a great answer, is that where the novel started is different from where it ended. And I do know that that's true. I mean, in terms of his conception of it. And so he was a very playful, I've already mentioned that he was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but his writing before Gatsby is much more playful and satirical, and he was much more facetious than people today, I think, often appreciate. And I think he's moving towards something that we would recognize as postmodernism there. It was, he often did that in his early stories. He has like stage directions, and he says things like, there's a story where that's published in a magazine, and he says at the end of it, the happy ending is she reached up and like kissed him on the screen, because he's envisioning it being a screen adaptation, right? So this very kind of meta, self-conscious games that he liked to play. And so I think he started out writing Gatsby to be something, he started out in a tone that was more like that. And that was the thing he had written just before Gatsby, was a play called The Vegetable, which flopped. And that was his sort of mode that he was in. And then my best answer to your question was, as I say, it's really unsatisfying, is that he just kind of liked it and he stuck with it, even though it didn't really suit the book that he eventually wrote.
Yeah, it does seem out of kilter.
I think it is.
And you'd think that if you were making up an epigraph entirely, that would be because you couldn't find one off the peg that fitted better. You
know? Exactly, exactly. And of course, This Side of Paradise is from Rupert Brooke. He'll then take Tender as the Night from Keats. And so he's perfectly capable of using the writers who he admired. He loved Rupert Brooke as a young man, the writers who he admired, and pulling from their poetry. He's very comfortable doing that. But with Gatsby, he struggled with the title of Gatsby, but why he wants to have this throwback, because this is it's a reference back to characters from This Side of Paradise who are fictionalized versions of his friends, himself and a friend of his. And so it's sort of a tip of the hat to his friend, John Peel Bishop. It's sort of a tip of the hat back to his own previous first successful book, because he skipped a couple of things in between. And so it is, it's an odd little moment. And yeah, there are other people will have different views on it.
But also, come back to something we touched on right at the very beginning, which was this question of how you can date Gatsby really precisely. And he puts in, you know, he has Nick reading a railway timetable at one point, or tram timetable that's dated, you know, valid from such and such time.
Mm.
Why do you think he did that? And what effect did that have on the reception book? Because we now think of it, difficulties with Jazz Age, cliches in the adaptations aside.
Mm.
as quite a sort of timeless classic.
Yeah.
And yet you risk dating it, doesn't it? If you go like, oh, well, this is just about this period in 22.
Yeah. Well, and that absolutely affected the reception, because what happened was the first readers thought it was this completely contemporary novel and they couldn't see any of the timeless aspects that we see so clearly now. They really thought here was this really talented writer throwing away all of this energy on these kind of trivial, sordid people and this kind of tabloidy story. And so again, the analogy I sometimes use is, imagine if somebody today wrote a novel that was going to be recognized in 100 years as the great novel of our moment, but it's about the Kardashians. Nobody would recognize it as a great work of art. They would just be so distracted, I argue. I mean, maybe we would, but I think most reviewers, if not all, would be so distracted by what they take to be the triviality of its subject matter that they wouldn't see it as a masterpiece. They might say it was smart, well-written, which people did say about Gatsby, but they were like, but why are you spending all of this energy on something that isn't worthy of that kind of thought? Now, maybe our thinking has advanced more than I
Is than even I think. More a parallel here?
Yeah, a little bit, but he's a bit later, right? He's a bit later. So he's actually learning from Fitzgerald, exactly. So for contemporary readers, the sense that it was just a few years ago and who cares about these people, that was very powerful to the point that it was sort of overwhelming. I think the reason that he did it was because he wanted to write a great treatise about modern American life. And so it needed to be specific. It needed to be set in a certain moment, because that's the moment that he's talking about. And he wanted all of those details. He wanted this kind of very specific aspect of American life that he was capturing. But also he chooses 1922 pretty clearly, because as we said in the beginning, he's starting to see by 1924-25 that was the year where literary modernism was born. And so he's taking his flag in the middle. You've got Ulysses at the beginning, The Wasteland at the end, and he's like, well, here I am in the summer of 1922 and I can do it too.
That's excellent. The ambitious way of reason for setting it when he set it. Now, you do hint, I mean, it's really down low hint in your introduction. You say, here and there, he overdoes it or he gets it wrong. Now, I think of this book as a book of almost kind of crystalline beauty in construction and sentence-by-sentence craftsmanship. But what are the flaws?
Well, I think there are some moments where, for me anyway, what constitutes great writing is subjective, of course, to a certain extent. But Fitzgerald at his best had this almost perfect pitch, this kind of really finely tuned ear for the beauties of the English language. But he can sometimes lose his footing and get a little bit overwrought. And there's a bit at the end of chapter 6 where Nick is recounting Gatsby's memory of kissing Daisy for the first time. And he's really ratcheting up the glamour and the idealism. And what he says is, out of the corner of his eye, Gatsby saw that the blocks of the sidewalk really formed a ladder and mounted to a secret place above the trees. He could climb to it if he climbed alone. And once there, he could suck on the pap of life, gulp down the incomparable milk of wonder. Nope. Sorry, Scott. You know, it just doesn't work right. It's incongruous. And it's one of the few moments to me in the novel where
breastfeeding and romance don't.
You know. Yeah, but you know, the pap of life and the incomparable milk of wonder. I'm just not sure that milk is just so mundane, right? And it's so quotidian that it just pulls all of the glamour down. You kind of thud back to dairy farms and you're like, why are we talking about milk? You know, so there are a couple of moments like that.
Is he at risk of cancellation? I should ask finally. I mean, there is Mayor Wolsheim is a very difficult character to read these days, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. The casual anti-Semitism of its day is here. So is the casual racism of its day. You know, Nick makes some references to Black people that, okay, he doesn't use the N-word, but they're offensive. And that's very much the kind of racism and anti-Semitism of the early to mid-1920s and of the early decades of the 20th century that Fitzgerald grew up with. I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying it's there. So, I mean, I'm not going to say how other people are going to react to it. I think the question for me about works that get canceled is how much the work depends on those moments, how much they're intrinsic to its meanings and its power and the claims it's making on greatness and the claims it's making on art. And so the example that I would give, he hasn't been canceled exactly, he's just being ignored, which for me is preferable to cancellation. I'd much rather people just stop reading people that they don't find interesting or useful anymore. But somebody like Saul Bellow, who was once, you know, an inescapable presence in the literary conversation, is fallen by the wayside. Many people you know, find that objectionable. He's obviously a wonderful writer in lots of ways. But Bellow's claim to greatness was about his claim to wisdom and humanism. When he won the Nobel Prize, it was all about how he was this great commentator on humanism. And then women came along and were like, well, he's pretty bad at 50% of the human race. Like, he's not actually great on women, right? And so for me, Bellow kind of stands or falls on that claim about humanism. And the books that are, that they were like the Gone with the Wind, which I've also written about, as you know, it's racism is intrinsic to it. You can't pull it out of it. Gatsby, you could pluck those scenes out. Fitzgerald thought they were funny. You could pluck those scenes out. Gatsby would not be in any way different, in my view.
My Wolfsheim could be an Italian gangster.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And it's a kind of cheap joke. He doesn't need the cheap joke of giving Wolfsheim this silly accent that he thinks is funny and all of this stuff. But none of it, the book doesn't depend on it, right? But what is important in the novel is that Tom Buchanan is a white supremacist and he's the bad guy. Now, that is very specific. It's a very clear choice. It's just that Fitzgerald had a different line of what he thought was acceptable and unacceptable. And again, I'm not trying to defend that. But it's important, I think, that we understand that Tom Buchanan's white supremacism is intrinsic. It's central to his villainy in the novel. It's central to the way that he construes power. And Fitzgerald was very outspoken about hating that kind of white supremacism, which was known as Nordicism in America at the time. And he wrote about it outside of Gatsby, about how he had no time for it. He thought it was garbage. And so this kind of what we, you know, would call, they're not really microaggressions, they're bigger than that, but is where that sort of stuff unconsciously slips in. But his conscious intention is to do something where white supremacists are the bad guys. But, you know, I'm white. And I'm Gentile. So it's easy for me to sit there and say that because he wants white supremacism to mark his villainous characters, that that should redeem the book. For other readers, it won't. It you know, it doesn't. So whether it will be canceled or not is, you know, is ultimately not for me to determine. But I don't think so, because I think that they're incidental enough that in my experience, most readers recognize that those were the attitudes of the past. And it doesn't mean that there's nothing redeemable in the novel. On the contrary, that most of it is not only, you know, beautifully written, as we've been saying, and prescient and prophetic and all the things we haven't yet said about it, but that its attitudes are not actually that different from our attitudes.
Yeah. Well, to finish by exactly what you just touched on, you make the point that it's of its time, but, you know, we also hold it to be kind of pretty universal. Does what it has to tell us about America stand up now, do you think? I mean, we're having this conversation 24 hours after the latest inauguration.
After the inauguration of January 2025. So, yeah, does the Great Gatsby predict somebody like Trump in the White House? Yeah, absolutely it does. It's a trajectory. I mean, he doesn't say it explicitly, obviously, but the trajectory that the novel sees America being on is a trajectory that ends with Trump in the White House. You bet it does.
Sarah Churchwell, thank you very much indeed. The new edition, Cambridge Centennial Edition of The Great Gatsby, is out, I think, any day now. Sarah, thank you very much indeed.